Don't risk overpaying for a property because you did not understand the profit and loss statement, guarantors, or the lease agreements. Hi, I'm Jared Krause. I'm the co-host of the Property Pals Australia podcast. And in this episode, Sam and I chat to Steve Polizzi, who is the founder of the buyer's agency firm Polizzi Property, where they bought over 1,000 properties for clients. And he's also the author of the book Commercial Property Explained Simply. In this pod, Steve shares all the documents you need to check when reviewing a lease, which is absolutely critical, and there's quite a few. We also discuss how to review a lease yourself and with the solicitor, and the things you should be looking out for that are common traps when valuing the property of a commercial investment. We also discuss the different types of guarantors a commercial property should have and what you should be looking for in a guarantor. Steve also shares some horror stories, which are great examples of how people have been burnt by missing information during lease agreement due diligence. And lastly, we touch on the different types of guarantors a commercial property should have and what you should be looking for in a guarantor. Now, there's a lot of value in this podcast episode. Let's get right onto it. Welcome to Property Pals, the podcast where we share everything around how to build a property portfolio, from researching areas, financing, structuring, buying, selling, and reinvesting to live a life of financial independence. As a disclaimer, any information shared by myself, Jared, Sam, and the Property Pals team is strictly general and should not be taken as constituting professional advice. You should consider seeking independent legal, financial, and taxation advice from a qualified professional. Steve, Sam, long time no see. It feels like it's been forever.
Yeah, I'm getting sick of you guys, let's be honest.
We're just milking all the value out of you. We're talking about lease agreements today and mistakes to avoid when you're looking at purchasing a lease agreement, Steve. And I mean, that's one of the biggest components. We talked about your due diligence checklist, guys. If you haven't listened to that podcast episode, I think it's three podcasts ago. Make sure you get a Steve's checklist there. But yeah, lease agreements, one really big one. What would be the top three biggest risks you would typically see in a lease agreement when purchasing?
Okay, so the hard thing about leases is there's two parts of it. So like I will look at it from an investor point of view, i.e. I want to cross-check everything that the agent's given me up front or in the information memorandum is actually true, because not bad mouthing agents, sometimes they don't actually give you the full truth of what's going on. So for me, is cross-checking the key figures. So the obvious ones are start date, end date, what the rent is, what the rental increases are, and then like who owns what and things like that. We'll go into that later. But just cross-checking the figures is actually, it's a task in itself, because you have to actually ask the owner for a rental statement saying, show me your bank account from the last 12, 24 months, and then cross-check what they've actually been paying. The other hard part is, because it is a bit of a Wild West commercial, anything can happen though. Like you never know about like under the table payments or things like that. Or as we mentioned in the last podcast with Value Add, is incentives. Sometimes incentives aren't there. They're kind of done as a cash payment because you want to keep the rent really high and they don't want it to come down because they don't want to pour a bank valuation. So first one, Jared, is actually just cross-checking the actual numbers, and you actually find five times out of 10, you find some form of discrepancy, whether it be from COVID or the numbers don't match up, or they haven't actually done the rental increases. It's because it was self-managed. They haven't actually increased the rent at the 3 or 5 or 7%. So that's the easiest one to do from an investor. But the reason why I said two people need to look at it, I look at it from the investor point of view. Then you also need a solicitor to look at it from a legal point of view, because I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to be a lawyer. They look at it to make sure it's foolproof. So if there is ever an argument, legally you're covered, because that's the whole purpose of a lease. It's a legal document, an agreement. I call it the rule book between the owner and the tenant. So they make sure it's legal. I make sure the numbers I'm happy with.
Yeah. So you'll typically check it first before you go and advise a legal practitioner, solicitor to look at it. Obviously, you're not going to do it, give it to somebody to do work on or pay for that fee if it's not, the numbers don't stack up, right? So where are some of the things where numbers don't stack up in a lease agreement?
The thing is, say like the bonds, for instance, so rental guarantees and personal guarantees and bonds, they might be somewhere in the contract, but if they're onto like the second or third option and say the rent's gone up, they haven't actually increased the bond. So say you bought something 10 years ago and they paid 2 months worth of rent as a bond, the rent's doubled, for instance, but they've still got the same fee. So the bond has less value. It's actually only equivalent to now like 1 month instead of 2 months. Same thing for rental guarantee. So just cross-checking what's actually there has actually been stipulated. But the other most common one is rental increases, especially where we are now, because we're in 2024. What happened with COVID is there was a lot of under the table agreements about, oh, no, we won't give you a rental incentive. We'll just not do rent increases for the next 3 years. Or there's some form of payback. They'll say, oh, look, during COVID, we'll give you 6 months free rent, but pay me back over the time. And this is the biggest headache for us because we don't actually see it. What happens is they might still be paying the other owner for that. So we need to kind of weigh up like, oh, should that be going to us? Should that be going to them? Who deserves what? And that's the biggest one where you can get a disgruntled tenant, whereas the new owner takes it on and there was a previous agreement that you didn't know about.
Or would it be the same case as like a new owner takes it on, the bond hasn't been added to or updated, and they are like, oh, you know, we've increased, double the rent, like you said, but you've only paid 2 months bond. It should be double that. Can you pay us that 2 months bond? That obviously off the bat creates a bad sort of a kick in the mouth, I would say, from the from the standpoint of the tenant. Like, well, do I really want to rent this property back off this new person?
Yeah, but this is why commercial is more complicated, because part of this is you actually call the tenant, obviously, and you kind of go over like making sure that they're fully aware of these are the conditions of why you're buying the property. I also get my property manager involved as early as I can as well, because they're the ones going to be taking it over. So they can also add another layer of protection that way. So that's the hard thing with commercial is it's just a big contract with lots of different variances. And there are standard like lease agreements, but you can change everything with special conditions. I've been lazy as well. Like during COVID on some of my properties, I probably should have done it like when I gave like a rent-free period and that. You'll rarely go back and change the lease because the lawyers, the incentive is actually going to be less than paying the lawyers. But again, where a good property manager can make note of it, have a paper trail, like email trails, and they record everything, even conversations. You have a conversation with the tenant, transcribe it into an email, send it to the tenant, get them to confirm. So just doing things like that.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And what are some of the other things you need to check through this lease, these lease agreements through the DD? Yeah.
The second biggest one is fit out and who owns the fit out. Cool. So, this can come from on both actually on all of them, industrial, retail, office space, for instance. Like for retail, for instance, who owns the kitchen or the medical fit out and things like that? Funnily enough, sometimes they don't even know, because like the property might have been a cafe for the last 15 years and the business has sold it on two or three times and the new tenant just thinks it's they own it because they bought into the business. Mm. Other times they think it's fixed and they can't take it. So this is a huge area of contention where you might want to keep the fit out, the tenant leaves, and then all of a sudden they take it away. So anytime you're buying a new property, kind of get an inventory list and kind of describe, okay, do we own this? You own this? And that sort of flows onto the make good clause. So the make good clause is when a tenant leaves, what condition they have to do it to. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, so like what condition, what state do they have to leave the premises in, basically? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. We had one recently where the tenant built the mezzanine area on an industrial, and then the lease was coming to end and they basically wanted to take it. And we're like, no, we bought this on the premise that we get that square meter rate. That's why we bought it. The mezzanine cost money, quite a lot of money. And their argument was they did it. So they therefore own it, but they didn't stipulate anywhere that they own it. And we were buying it as is condition. So again, these complexities is why I obviously do as a buyer's agent to stop these mistakes happening, because I've seen them before, but there is huge gray zones, which you need to be aware of.
And so what happens in that situation where they're like, oh no, like we own the, you know, we own that mezzanine, that part of the, you know, the property. Is that something you go, well, it's not worth the deal anymore, and you sort of walk away?
No, not necessarily. I never try to walk away from a deal if I've bought an area where the fundamentals are strong. Because we're doing this all under the due diligence clause, we've got options then. So the option is, Okay, first thing we do is try to find the paper trail or try to prove that they've, say, owned the mezzanine floor. And if they do, then you can either go back and offer to buy it off them because it's already there anyway, so they might look at that. Generally, what we'll do is we'll actually try to get a price negotiation based on that. So we can either quote up a new mezzanine if they do take it and try to get that off the asking price. But what normally happens is you'll negotiate the price that the previous owner would have to pay the tenant to leave it, kind of thing. So you try to get a workaround as best you can. But like you said, if that is one of the main reasons you're buying, and this often happens not so much with the office space, with industrial, but like medical suites and kitchens and things like that, walk away. Like if you're not happy, the beauty of a due diligence clause is walk away. But I'd say 9 out of 10 times we come up with the solution because the previous owner, if we crush a deal based on, might only be 20 grand, for instance, and on a $1 million deal, they're going to have to go back to the market, have another due diligence clause, have another tenant, give all the documents over again. They might crash as well. It could extend their kind of process by 3, 4, 5 months. So we normally try to make up a solution because I know I'm buying in the really tightly held areas.
Yeah. You want to make a win-win for everybody. And you've already spent these time and resources on it. Like, what's the point wasting if you can make it work, right? Like, that's...
The hard one is because if I'm buying a property with a really good, strong lease, sometimes they don't actually know. So like that's the problem. Like there'll be a mezzanine and you can ask the tenant like, oh, do you own that? And they go, no, I don't think so. And then you're going to go, well, we need to write a document to say this is part of the sale because in 10 years time, I don't know, you might sell into another business. And then when they've sold the business, they've told them that they get to keep that. That's theirs. And then they want to take it. So you can get disagreements. And I know I talk about commercial being passive of like, oh yeah, tenant pays for everything. Ownership is probably the biggest one, and that's kind of the headaches.
Yeah. Cool. So we've got the tenants, like obviously maybe they do or don't own part of the building or the fit out. And then we've also got, you know, what you mentioned before is like getting the lease agreement looked at and the numbers are working. What else is there in like lease agreements that are pretty tricky that could catch, you know, a buyer off guard if they're buying it without the help of a buyer's agent such as yourself?
Yep. So I've got kind of two more. So the first one's probably rental increases. And I'm going to sort of flip this a little bit. I find most people worry about the rental increases way more than they should. So like 5 years ago, you didn't want CPI. Everyone was focusing on like 5% because CPI was lower than that. Now everyone wants CPI instead of 3% rental increase because CPI is higher. But I've actually found like even if you've got like unless you're buying a Bunnings or a Woolworths or something with a huge long lease, like most people are buying a 3 to 5 year lease maximum. The rental increase is such a small portion in the grand scheme of things. And I'm not diminishing it. Long term, it's really important to have rental increases and get the capital growth. But if you say have, I don't know, 7% rental increases on the property for 5 years and their rent starts far outstretching the market rent, I can tell you, you're going to have an unhappy tenant and they're going to ask for a rental reduction anyway. So there's that. And then inversely, say they're only on like people go, oh, I want 5 and you're only on 3 for the next 3 years. You work it out as an actual cost. Like on a 60 grand rent, for instance, it's only a 5 grand decision. So people get really caught up on like, oh no, I'm not getting like these extra rental increases. At the end of each lease term, there's a market review. So it's going to come back to market rent. So just work it out over that period. But without sounding arrogant, I don't care about 5 grand if I'm making a $1 million purchase. It's about, is the tenant good? Is the location good? Is the lease waterproof and tight? That's the main one I kind of want to look at there.
Yeah. Like for example, if you're going for a tenant that will pay more money because they're desperate to have the place, but they're also the business isn't doing so well. You run the risk of having a great solid tenant or a great solid business in the premises renting it that could stay on for 15 years versus like, let's get an extra couple of percent out of them in the first few years of ownership, right?
Yep. No, spot on. So that's sort of leads on to the next one as well. Is actually the guarantees and the bonds. So we touched on the bonds before, but most people don't even know how to check a guarantee. So like there's two types of guarantees.
Yeah, what is the guarantee?
Yeah. So the guarantee is the tenant kind of promising that they're going to uphold the contract of the lease. So there's two types. There's a personal guarantee. So that's them putting themselves up personally versus like a bank guarantee. They've each got a pro and a con. So like the personal one, it's a little bit harder because like theoretically, if they business does really bad, they could sort of declare bankruptcy. So you're not going to get it out of it. So part of that is checking their collateral, like making sure they've got a house and doing all that. The bank guarantees are a bit tighter that way because the bank holds it. And then actually, I should say there's a third. There's obviously a company guarantee as well. That's probably the highest risk because guess what? If they're not paying the rent and business is suffering, the company's not worth anything. Yeah. So you want to get like a personal or a bank guarantee if you can. But again, it's just like who within residential actually checks the tenants' like personal circumstances. Like the property manager will be like, oh, they're great. That's a nurse and a chippy and they always paid their rents on time. That's all you do. They don't put up a house or something as collateral. But they're also not typically signing like a five-year lease. So that confuses some people, but the type of property is kind of what I worry about. Again, it's one of those ones clients will really get caught up on, like, oh, there's no personal guarantee. There's only a bond. If I'm buying like a warehouse and the vacancy rate's 1 to 2 months anyway, it's not that critical to the deal.
It's a real backup, isn't it?
It's a backup. But if I'm buying, say, a medical center, where I'm paying an absolute premium because it's a medical center and it's got to fit out and I like that business, I definitely want to see a personal guarantee because if they sign that and do it at a premium, especially if it was like a lease back or something like that, and they decide to leave, I've just paid 20% too much for that property. So I want to make sure that I can at least get the lease out as a layer of protection. It gives me time. So just checking those things are probably the big ones as well.
And with the guarantee, so the business having a guarantee or the business having like a personal guarantee, would they also combine maybe some of the plants and the equipment in the property as part of guarantee? Like, or is that?
This is where it gets complicated. Generally not. You'll kind of have an inventory list, which sort of alludes onto like another one. So like part of the lease, they'll sometimes have special conditions. So the special conditions can be like I mentioned, like the undocumented like incentives, the rental concessions, if there's cancellation or termination clauses, sometimes they'll have like a clause where they can actually get out and only give you 3 months notice, even if they've signed a long lease. So that this is where probably more so where you need the lawyer to have a look at it. Special building allowances, if there's any additional expenses. So we obviously touched on other ones where they pay 100% of the outgoings, but sometimes there'll be stuff that they don't have to nominate, like they're not responsible for the air conditioning or the refrigeration or whatever it may be like that. One I've seen recently. Oh, demolition clauses. So there's ones where the owner potentially may, it might be in your advantage, is you can kick them out if you need to demolish the site. So i.e. you want to do a development or something like that. So the special conditions is probably like the last one where it gets really tricky and really gray. But that's also the beauty of commercial, is you can negotiate absolute anything and then kind of go from there.
Yeah, got ya.
Yeah.
So as a brand new buyer, the buyer's agent is going to typically go through all these things. What's the one that really catches people off guard mostly out of those sort of four that you've mentioned?
Probably the rent not matching the rental statements. Like that's the easiest one, and it's the most common. People just take it for face value. And it gets quite complicated sometimes because like, you'll ask for a rental statement and they'll say no. And then they give you an Excel spreadsheet saying this is when they paid. And you're kind of like, should I trust this? Should I not trust this? Yeah. So I'll change my answer a little bit. The lack of information is probably gets what people are most caught off guard and what means they can't pull the trigger because they don't like my due diligence checklist. It has like 100 things you request.
So many documents that you have to get.
You don't always get it. So like, oh, shall I just pull it up now? So like, just for lease review. So the documents you need to get are the lease, amendments to the lease, subleases, rental abatements, licenses, insurance, permits, development approvals of tenants' business, the car parking arrangements, bank guarantees, personal guarantees, lease securities, the list of the owner's fixtures and fittings being sold, evidence of payment from the vendor, for any tenant's fixtures. So they have to prove that they actually paid, which we mentioned before, a list of what fittings they own, a depreciation schedule, any undocumented incentives. Then you've got like, you've got to go over the lease details of start date, end date, renewal, whether it's personal name or company who's signing the lease. Then there's rent review. So look at the rent reviews. Ratchet clause, that's another one we didn't look at. So sometimes there's a clause saying you can't actually put the rent down. It's locked in, it can only go up. Security, so find out about the security, who owns what, how much they value, and you've got to verify all them. Then there's a whole checklist about fit out and make good clauses. Then you need to get the insurances. So what the insurance they're kind of putting up for like public liability or public indemnity. Then you got to get all the outgoings to cross-check with the lease as well, because you're not just checking the rent that they're getting. You're checking that like the council rates, the water rates, the maintenance are also being paid. Then there's assignment and subleasing. So like my cafe, for instance, they sold the business to another one. So there's like a sublease. So you've got like the previous owner banking it, but then the new one, how they fit into it. The tax part, so making sure they're paying GST component of the rent. Then the special conditions, so nominated car parks, document incentives, are the ones I went through before. So there's quite a lot. Just, and this is just the lease review. So this yeah. This is where commercial, where the work comes in. And you'll see Jared with the property we're looking for you. Like when we give you like the 80-page due diligence report, you'll go, "Geez, well, there's a lot here. Is this actually a good property?"
Yeah.
And the hard thing is, and this sort of goes back to your question, there's no such thing as a perfect property. Like whenever I actually find one with zero issues, I'm always like, what have I missed? There's something I've had to have missed here. This is too good to be true. Normally what happens is the other way. I actually think I'm buying a mediocre property and I actually find something that the agents actually missed. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, this has just turned into a cracker of a deal now. I'm not going to tell the agent.
Yeah. Yeah. And you get the deal for the same price the agent wants it without seeing, say, maybe a value add or something in the lease agreement that you have learned about that they don't know.
As simple as the rent being wrong, they've said the rent and the rent's actually like 20% higher and they've actually been paying that. But because the owner hasn't told them that correctly, they've given them the wrong number. They probably looked at the lease or something like that and used the wrong date. And that, in those cases, definitely don't tell the agent. They've just missed the mark with it.
Yeah, that's huge. That's huge. So, you know, the property is obviously returning a higher yield than what they're selling it for. That's awesome. On the other, so that's really like, that's their huge benefits, right, that you are finding out through due diligence, through so many deals that you've looked at. Have you heard, what is maybe like one or two horror stories that you've heard of people that haven't used a buyer's agent, go and buy a property with and not foreseen some things in the lease agreement that really hurt them?
Yeah, so I sort of alluded to it before. I've had ones where like a medical tenant and a cafe tenant, actually it wasn't cafe, it was a restaurant, it was a Thai restaurant. The tenant wanted to leave and then just took all the stuff and they didn't actually care and they just disappeared. The Thai restaurant, we believe they went back overseas. So they actually didn't care about like the bond and that. They just kind of, they must have sold all the equipment. And then the owner's just sitting there being like, I've got this empty shell now with no guarantees. And retails generally have a longer lease period. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was the medical one where they wanted to take all the machines and fit outs and things like that. And break the lease because them moving on was actually more valuable, but they paid a premium for it. So they're probably the two that I don't have that many horror stories from clients, obviously, because we do all this work. Yeah. So it's normally people. I'd say the biggest one I see is people missing the mark and just buying something silly that they didn't really understand. So I spoke previously at a medical conference, and one of them there bought a big Centrelink freestanding building that looked all attractive, had a 5-year lease, but it was so one-dimensional. When they left, all the value they put into was the tenant, thinking there's no way a Centrelink's going to leave, and then they left. So they paid 20-30% too much for the property. Then they're just left with a kind of awkward office building in a high vacancy rate area. So that was more they're trying to get rich quick. And this is the same thing with Resi. People chase yield. They're like, I'm going to chase yield. And they just take on risks that they shouldn't be taking on.
Yeah. Yeah. So they obviously did see if there was a guarantee from Centrelink or anything like that, and they just have an empty vacant.
No, so they actually, Centrelink were pretty good because government tenant. It was just when the lease finished, like they didn't assess the risk of the tenant leaving. Actually, no, here's one I personally had as well. So we bought a property that was a nail salon. This is early on in my first commercial investing. Everything stacked up. Now someone was there. We inspected the property. It's all going kind of well. They want a long lease. They didn't have strong guarantees. They only had a bond. And then our client bought the property. This is on the Northern Beaches. And then literally 2 weeks later, the property manager's like, I can't get a hold of them. Like I've called, because they inspected the property prior to going, called and then actually went to the shop to go talk to them. Shop completely empty. They've just completely cleaned up and left. And they've obviously been in cahoots with the owner of the property. So part of our due diligence, like we try to find if there's some relation. So we do like, we look like their We do like a credit history check on the owner, see what entity they're buying under. But I imagine though, this is stereotyping and I don't want to sound racist, but they were both the same culture, the seller and the type of tenant. So then you kind of envision, okay, did they know them and get them to sign a really long lease to get that premium of a price, which we did. We probably paid 5%, 10% more than say a vacant property because it had a good strong lease on it. And then we're back to square one. But this is where I talk about you buying the right area, it doesn't matter. Like where are the Northern Beaches? We filled it in about 4 months time and got another lease on. But you do get those horror stories sometimes and there's nothing to do. All the work that I did, the 60, 70 page due diligence report on it, couldn't find the connection. And in hindsight, we went through and I was just like, what could I have actually done better to find this out?
But it's pretty hard to find a connection that's not on paper anywhere, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. And again, hopefully not sounding racist, but like when we tried to interview the tenant, it was very hard to get anything out of them because of the language barrier.
Yeah.
So like they're kind of just answering yes or no questions. So even me asking them like, hey, how's business? Are you planning to stay on? Things like that. Sometimes that you'll get a bit of a gut feel, but that one I couldn't. So yep, missed the mark on that one a little bit, but still a good outcome for the client. And that was what, 4 years ago. And now that property is worth about 30, 40% more. So they're still happy.
And like you said, you're really looking at the day, like what I've noticed is like the days, not the days on market, I guess, but like the time it can take to re-let the property on average in that area based on that asset type, right? Like it could be, sometimes it could be like 15 days to 60 days. Yeah. And then you factor that into when you're purchasing it to like, oh, if I need a new tenant like fast, then that's what I'm going to be up for in terms of expenses for the repayments of the property when it's unleased, right?
Yeah, especially for retail where it's harder to get some kind of trust in that number. So like we bought the properties in Newport in the Northern Beaches. So you go on that main street, there's always a few vacancies and some of them are vacant for like a year, some are 2 years, some are 4 months. The reason I like this one was it was kind of on the corner of the main intersection. So it had really good street frontage. So everyone could see it from every angle. And I was like, if this tenant leaves, and I didn't expect them to actually leave, but they did, it could have been a cafe or it had the most exposure, the area, and that's why we filled it so quickly. Whereas if you'd bought the same thing, like, you know how they got offshoots down like alleyways and things like that? They don't have the foot traffic. That vacancy period is going to be much longer.
But how do you calculate the foot traffic? Like how do you track it? Like how does one commercial property track the foot traffic?
Inspections. So send. So you'll normally have a few people look at the property. Hopefully your buyer's agent will look at it. Normally if I can't be there, if it's in an area that I can't do, I actually send the property manager down at different times of the week. So I say a lot of the times they don't have to. Like if you get a good property manager, I call them up and like, oh, what's the buzz of this area like? And they're like, yeah, it's always busy, quieter on Wednesdays, but that's because of people working from home, whatever it is, and go from there. If you're unsure, go look at the property, but go look at it multiple times. So don't just fly up there and look at it on a random Tuesday at lunchtime. Book out a week, go work from there from a week and go inspect it at different times of days. But this is part of the grunt work and why it's actually really hard. You have to have looked at it. But because we've got multiple people looking at it, we've got the building pest inspector, the valuer, the property manager, and the buyer's agent in most circumstances as well. So you've got four people looking at it. So as long as you time those at different parts of the week, you can get a pretty good feel for the area.
Yeah, love it. I love it. Steve, thanks so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure to chat. And guys, if you haven't yet already got Steve's book, you can get it for free. Property Pals is the code. There'll be a link to that in the description. But yeah, Steve, thanks for coming on and look forward to chatting again soon.
Thanks, mate. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Sam.